Top 100 Project.
And action.
Howdy, everybody, and mucho gratitude for lending some time to the Top 100 Project, the podcast that reviews the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 lists of the 100 greatest American movies. Take caution. We will be shooting spoilers at you like John Wayne on a buffalo hunt. I'm Ryan Ellis with the avowed fan of Westerns, my wife Bev.
That's me, partner. That was lame.
Maybe later in the podcast you'll do better. So the coming attractions trivia for this week's film, The Searchers. The movie was nominated for no Oscars. What was the most recent AFIer that we've already reviewed, which didn't receive at least one nomination? And the second part of this is, what's the next one?
Received no nominations?
Zero nominations.
Third Man?
Nope. Because it won for its cinematography, and I think it was nominated for editing and director and whatnot. It was Sullivan's Travels.
Well,
way back in 1941.
I think the Academy knew something that the rest of the critics didn't. I happen to agree with them on that.
What about the next one? What do you think the next one is to get no nominations? Can you give up then?
Yeah, I give up. I don't know.
It's a trick question. Every other film we will do now had at least two nominations.
Are you kidding?
Yep. Even Blade Runner had two nominations but didn't win. Most films, I think, that we're going to do won at least one Oscar, in fact, from this point on.
Wow.
12 Angry Men actually didn't win. We do that very soon, but yeah.
Wow.
Last time that that will happen. So the Top 100 Project's 50th movie, The Searchers, squeaked onto AFI's 1998 list in 96th place between Pulp Fiction and Bringing Up Baby, but rocketed up a record-setting 84 spots to 12th in 2007 between City Lights and Star Wars. Warner Brothers released The Searchers on March 13th, 1956. While not a huge moneymaker, it did fine at the box office. Bev will tell you all about it in the skinny.
John Wayne is Ethan Edwards, a Confederate Civil War veteran whose West Texas family is murdered by natives of the Comanche tribe. He and his adopted nephew, Martin, played by Jeffrey Hunter, set out to find Ethan's niece, Debbie, played by Natalie Wood. She's the kidnapped lone survivor of the slaughter. The very long quest becomes Ethan's obsession.
To commit murder. So in a nutshell, racist war vet doesn't act on homicidal urges the instant he can finally achieve that goal. Let's go home, Debbie. One of many quotes I will lay on you from this film, none of which made the AFI's top 100 quotes list.
I'm surprised That'll Be the Day didn't seem to be the famous one.
First trivia question, right off the bat.
Yeah.
What singer was inspired to write a song using that as the title of the song?
It was Buddy Holly, right?
Buddy Holly.
It was his first hit, wasn't it? His breakout hit?
Oh, it might have been. I don't know about that.
I could be wrong about that.
Well, that'll be the day.
And that was pulled directly from this movie.
Yeah, he saw the movie and liked it. And also a fellow Texan.
Ah, yeah.
So, we're not Texans, but what did you think of The Searchers?
I liked The Searchers. I liked it less than I expected to because I've been loving the Western so much and I loved our two previous John Ford films that we saw. I think I had really high expectations, which may have been a mistake coming into this movie, but I also kind of stand behind my iffiness because there's some stuff that's great, some elements of it that make it fabulous and a classic and a really fun movie to watch and a really well-constructed movie, but then there's elements that just drag it down and kind of spoil it a little bit. Maybe it doesn't ruin it, but it certainly surprises me that people call this a masterpiece.
If I could have flashed ahead to this conversation before we watched the movie, I would have thought you were full of beans, but no, I think I'm going to have to agree with you on that.
Because this time watching the movie, it's...
The subplots. Other reviewers have pointed this out, too. I think you probably read the same
thing. Yeah, yeah, over and over.
That people would say that and still say, but still, it's a masterpiece.
Yeah, it's like everyone goes, okay, it's full of flaws, but this is still a masterpiece. It reminds me a little bit of when we saw Night at the Opera, and there was all those silly singing vignettes that would, like, break away and suddenly get serious, and those two main actors that weren't the Marx Brothers.
Yeah.
And Ebert himself is like, all you have to do is fast forward those scenes, and it's a wonderful movie.
Right.
And how, like, Swing Time, all you have to do is fast forward everything but the singing and dancing, and it's a wonderful movie. And maybe if an editor could have just... Although I don't think an editor could have saved it, because the character of Martin is what... It's almost as if they were making two totally different movies, and they took the stars of these two totally different movies and put them together. The tone is completely different. You have the really sober, deep, and complicated Ethan, who's a great character and a great he's not even a hero. He's kind of, could call him an anti-hero.
He's pretty close to being a villain.
Yeah, if you look at him and Scar, who's his nemesis, who's the Comanche who committed the original crime, slaughtered this family, and kidnapped this girl.
Two girls, actually, and then killed one of them.
Yeah, that's right. And you compare Scar's behavior to Ethan's behavior, they both feel justified. They both have done terrible things.
Yep.
The only reason that we seem to, as the audience, be empathizing with Ethan is he happens to be the character that we're following in this story. You can make a whole different movie all about Scar from his perspective, and he would be the hero, and mm-hmm. Ethan would be the big villain.
Scar even says in the scene when they all sit down together that I think it's two sons were killed,
mm-hmm.
obviously by white men, probably by military men. And so he has these wives in lieu of for his family, one of which we learn in that scene. Is Debbie, as she's gotten to be a young teenager.
Not just wives, but scalps as well. Women's scalps, you can see.
Yeah.
They even show some of the carnage from the cavalry when they come in. That's the scene where Luke has killed his squaw bride, Martin's squaw bride, is killed along with lots of other people, women and children. You know, the atrocities committed against the Indians in this movie are definitely as bad as what the Comanche did to Ethan's family.
Yeah, it's always tough to watch an old Western that indicts the natives wholesale when we know that our race, white people, murdered so many of them and stole their land. But yeah, in this context, Scar is a villain. And you're right, you flip it over,
mm-hmm.
and the white people are. And we're still in an era when Indians, or well, I guess natives we should be calling them, are clearly the bad guy. And Ford had been insensitive about natives in the past with his other movies. He makes them savages here, too. Like you said about the scalping, the fact that they go after this family and they set out a decoy. It's supposed to be that they stole Jorgensen's cattle, but instead, no, it's lure these guys out and then murder everybody. But at least the hero isn't very heroic.
No.
And Ethan's often a horrible bastard.
He's a racist bastard, and it seems pretty intentional in the script, in his performance, and Ford's directing that the audience is supposed to be turned off and disgusted with the amount of hate in his heart. And it's not even just him, even Lori, when she learns that Martin took a squaw bride, the disgust that she has for that.
Vera Miles plays her, yeah. She says about how Martha would have wanted Debbie to be killed, which is what Ethan's hunt
eventually
turns into when he realizes, well, she's turned, so now I gotta kill her. So Lori's implying that Martha's racist because I'd rather she be dead than live like that. And Lori's okaying this, so she's...
Oh, yeah, they seem to condone it, the racism. Right. Debbie, a 14-year-old girl, needs to now be murdered. It's better for her to be dead than live as a Comanche.
Yeah, better be dead than red. This is the 50s, right? We're talking about communism. There's no subtext of communism in this movie, but this certainly would have been heard all across America. Better dead than red. Well, in this case, if we want to keep on racism, of course, natives are often called red skins. You know, there's that controversy with the football team right now in Washington. A lot of people won't even call them the Redskins anymore because they're just so disgusted by the fact this is still their team name. Yeah. And that's a whole thing. Colbert did an episode.
Yeah, that's all that right.
Too, so.
But in the 50s, this attitude of sympathy towards the natives in a Western, in a traditional Western, was new. It was a very innovative film in that sense that the hero was racist and that was condemned and that the behavior of the Indian chief was sympathized with or at least explained and rationalized in a manner that anyone watching the film could at least a little bit understand. It's hard to just stay exactly on the side of your white blue-eyed hero when you see all the complicated factors that go into the situation that they're in.
There's also a history, because if you remember the gravestone where Debbie runs off when we see Scar looming over her, the tombstone reads Mary Jane Edwards. That's Ethan's mother, and she was killed by Comanche in 1852.
Oh.
The movie's set in 1868, so just after the Civil War. Ethan's been gone for 3 years. It's murky where he was. The Reverend, finally, our last Ward Bond performance.
Yes.
A pretty major one. He's actually in the movie a lot. And he plays, what is his name? Reverend Captain Samuel Johnson? He's both a captain in the military and a reverend. He's the one that suggests about Ethan, you fit a lot of descriptions, meaning he's another fugitive like he was in Stagecoach.
Yeah, he has Yankee gold, which, you know, everyone's like, how'd you get this? There's no legitimate way to get this. And the medal that he gives to Debbie before she gets kidnapped is like a Mexican Medal of Honor.
Yeah, it's suggested that he served as a mercenary in the French-Mexican expedition right after the Civil War. And of course, he admits he never gave up. He never surrendered his lance, that sword dealy. Which he gives to his nephew, and it reminded me a little of seeing the best years of her life.
Totally.
But at least this kid's happy to get it.
I know, like any teenage kid would be.
And had he not been killed, he might have found use for that thing.
Yeah.
Unlike the kid in Best Years of Her Lives, he was, I guess we'll take it.
So you have this like really beautiful, complex story with lots of depth. It's serious, it's melodramatic. And then you have the character of Martin, Polly, who is practically brain damaged. He's so stupid. In all those 5 years he spends with Ethan and the voyage they go on, this odyssey that they go on, mm-hmm. he somehow manages to remain completely unchanged, unfazed. He does not learn a thing. He doesn't grow up. He stays stupid. He stays naive and yeah. immature through all of this. And he's kind of this comic relief. And this is where I say this, to me, was the big flaw of the film, is he doesn't fit in. His side storyline with his sort of fiancée, Lori, who he's too stupid to put together that she wants to get married and yeah. he's going to lose her.
And she almost marries Charlie, that
Hayseed.
Over the top Hayseed. Yeah. I'm going to marry that girl there.
I kind of was rooting for them to get married. Like, give up on this dummy. Why are you waiting
Well,
for
this
him?
Is one of the dumb subplots.
Yeah.
And we were both laughing during their comical fight scene.
It's cute, but it belongs in a different movie.
Yeah. Ethan is a homicidal person. This movie, and we'll get into influences all through the podcast, I guess let's start with one right now, Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
Because Travis Bickle is very much like Ethan Edwards, very much bordering on being a villain himself.
Mm-hmm.
At best, he's an anti-hero who's trying to save a girl who may not want to be saved in the first place.
Yeah, a 14-year-old
the character,
girl.
Yeah, mm-hmm. the character in Taxi Driver pretty much doesn't want to be saved.
Yeah.
And I've always suggested that if the end of Taxi Driver is not his imagination, and he really does save her, and he really does get her back to Pittsburgh with her family, she's not going to stay there.
Yeah.
And we'll talk more about that when we get to Taxi Driver. You wonder the same kind of thing with this movie. Here's Debbie with people that she doesn't really know all that well. They're not literally
yeah.
family. They're
she's been
close
spoiled.
Enough you'd call them family.
Yeah. And nobody's going to marry her. She's
yeah.
always going to remain
she's
an
ruined.
Outcast as long as she lives.
And she lived
yeah.
a whole different life. I mean, she was supposed to be, I guess it's 9. You said 5 years. She looks like she's about 14. We suggest that Scar essentially raped her.
Of course.
If she was his
yeah.
wife. Yeah.
yeah.
Back in those days, that might have been looked at differently too. Because that's another thing about movies of this period. We have racism, which is changing now. In the mid-50s, even John Ford, an old guy, is starting to realize that maybe I shouldn't just portray these people as horrible savages and that's it. But there's also still an awful lot of sexism back in the mid-50s.
And they're portraying a credibly sexist period of history, too, where women are portrayed as property.
So we're in an era in the 50s where women still aren't thought of as equals. You could argue they're still not thought of enough as equals even now. And like you say, portraying an
mm-hmm.
era when they absolutely weren't.
Where having been raped by somebody means that you're better off dead.
Yeah. Now, here's a subtext, not a subplot, that does work, I think, pretty well. There's a suggestion in the movie, it's never overt, that Ethan and Martha, his brother's wife, that Ethan has feelings for her and maybe had a relationship with her, and maybe even Debbie is his daughter.
Well, the suggestion that they have a relationship above and beyond in-laws is pretty clear. Not just the way he greets her, he kisses her forehead, it's really very tender. But also the way she smells his jacket
yeah.
and she's putting it
Which
away.
Which the Reverend sees. No one else sees it,
yeah,
but he does.
Yeah, but it's there, right? There's some connection. Whether or not Debbie's his daughter, that's hard to say, but then you could still make the connection that this guilt he feels about cuckolding his brother or being
yeah.
in love with his sister-in-law or maybe crossing the line or not, but that guilt that he feels about the crime he committed against his brother's family could be one of the motivations that keeps him on the road for 5 years.
Doing his penance, yeah.
He's like Captain Ahab. His search for vengeance is so intense and kind of single-minded.
I read that Ahab comparison in my research, too. I never thought of it quite that way before, and I think it's a good point. But in this case, Ahab finds and kills the white whale. What would the actual Ahab, not Ethan, have done if he had survived the fight as Ethan does? Because let's talk about the last shot of this movie, the very famous last shot. Ethan's achieved his goal now. Well, he was going to try to murder her, but he achieved his original goal. He saved Debbie.
Mm-hmm.
He's got her back. Martin's with Lori. Everything seems to be fine. Ethan has inherited Aaron's property and the cattle and everything, but does he really have a place to go? And as he walks off and that door closes, and we see
Beautiful
it many times.
Shot.
I think
famous.
It's at least 4 times in the movie. Everyone knows, I think, that the most famous part of this movie is that camera's inside of a house, dark inside, bright light of the complete vast wilderness behind.
Monument Valley, gorgeous vista.
Right. And Ethan walks away into nowhere. And as he says earlier about how he shoots out the eyes of the Comanche, who's already been dead and buried because he has to wander forever between the winds. Well, as James Woods points out in one of the AFI specials, that extended one we watched, that's what Ethan's going to have to do now, wander
yeah.
forever between the winds. He also almost seems unkillable.
He gets an arrow, and at some point Martin says to him, you should be dead. You shouldn't survive that shot, but he does.
That'll be the day. In that song, in the Buddy Holly song, that'll be the day when I die.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
In other words, I'm not going to die.
Mm-hmm.
You get that great shot looking out from inside the Western Vista. We see it even in the cave right at the end when Debbie's running away from him, and he's about to kill her, sees her finally, and changes instantly. Let's go home, Debbie. But even that is outside, inside looking out.
She's so terrified and traumatized in that scene. Even when he cradles her, she still has that look in her eyes like
yeah.
she's just waiting for him to snap her neck. She's
yeah.
convinced he's going to kill her.
And he's so big he could have done it. He doesn't need it coming.
Oh, yeah.
And just before that, as he's running off and Martin's trying to stop him, he's pistol whipping his adopted nephew.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And Martin somehow catches up to him. Martin's very fast though, because early in the movie when his horse has died, And Moe's, there's another bad subplot, Moe's Harper. Yeah. Moe's knows, just give Moe's a rocking chair. God.
By the end, every time he came on screen, I was like, come on, no more Moe's.
Yeah, he was irritating. But as he and Ethan ride back to the Edwards farm, even though Martin's been left behind somewhere, at least miles back, he somehow catches up to them almost instantly. Now, there's another homage, Star Wars, when Luke comes home to find his aunt and uncle have been burned by someone who ends up being his enemy. So you got Ethan and Scar on this movie have this big conflict, and you've got Luke and Darth Vader, it's his orders to have killed. And as we learn in the prequels, well, of course, they didn't know this was maybe the first movie, he's having his own stepbrother and wife killed.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's his family that Luke was raised by.
So that's an homage in that scene. It's one of the more dark moments in a not a very dark original series, at least. I guess the second movie gets dark. Empire Strikes Back does. But when Luke comes home and sees the only people he's ever known, and they're literally burned. I mean, we don't see Martha and Aaron and the son. We don't see the corpses. Presumably, they've been mutilated and everything else.
Yeah.
And by the way, when they come back in that scene, they must have missed the Comanche by seconds because those fires are raging awfully high.
But you need to see something that traumatic and that violent.
And dramatic as well.
And dramatic to get the plot moving. To take Martin out of his cozy life and send him on the road with this guy who treats him like dirt for 5 years. You need something that's that severe.
You mentioned Ebert and you mentioned the flaws that people point out, yet they still give this movie such a pass. But Ebert even points out that they spend all this time on the road together. Do they ever have any conversations? The movies, whenever there isn't one of those silly subplots, it is always straight ahead. It's about this search to find this girl. And Ethan would be driven. I'm not saying he should go out there and have an affair with somebody or like Butch and Sundance, just mess around out in the middle of the Western nothingness. But what do they ever talk about? Is there anything in his life other than this? Other than avoiding getting killed and killing other people?
Yeah, they don't seem to grow close. This is my major problem with it. They don't seem to develop as characters or develop a relationship with each other. Even Luke Skywalker, who's a whiny sissy in the first Star Wars, by Return of the Jedi, he's kind of hardcore. He's a competent man at that point in the film. Martin should have come back a competent man. Maybe he wouldn't have been smarter, but he sure as hell would have been wiser.
It's funny, too, that they never have in any way one of those grudgingly accepting each other kind of things.
No.
Even a movie like, for some reason, The Hustler just came to my mind, where Paul Newman and Jackie Gleason are never friends, but I guess the connection they both have is they're top pool players. And at the end, there's seemingly this respect that's come out of it. And Gleason's character has learned, okay, he's where he needs to be now. He's hardcore. I beat him before because of his lack of character, which is what George C. Scott says. So they have that kind of connection. We could sit here and name 100, 200, 300 other movies where characters, not necessarily in the, where they literally hug, but they have some kind of acceptance for each other. The closest thing to an acceptance between Martin and Ethan in this movie is when Ethan has written out his will in case he doesn't make it.
Right.
And all of it's been willed to Martin. So there's a nice thing in a way. And it's not that John Wayne has to have a soft face in that moment, like, okay, well, yeah, you're all right after all, kid. He's, like I said, he's pistol whipping him seconds before he's trying to go kill his niece slash daughter, whatever she is to him.
Who is Martin's adopted sister.
Right. That obviously doesn't pan out. They do go back home. I don't know. Maybe it's not a weakness, but this movie's unusual in that sense. Mm-hmm. That they never. But then you pointed out, it's Matthew Weiner, the Mad Men guy, who said, people don't change.
Yeah, he said that's his overarching theme of Mad Men. People don't change. So maybe that's the theme of The Searchers. He's not going to change. That's why he can't come home. That's why he doesn't have a happy ending like everybody else. And why there's that beautiful last shot of him walking away into the vista. Because he'll always be that guy. He won, but he loses because he's the type of guy that would go on a quest like that in the first place.
One of the guys who's on the quest in the beginning, there's three of them at the very beginning, and it's Harry Carey Jr. that plays Brad Jorgensen, who'd been Lucy's beau before she got killed, and then he gets himself killed in a stupid sort of raid.
Yeah.
An interesting bit of casting by John Ford there. His mother plays his mother.
Oh,
Olive
sorry.
Carey, who's the wife of Harry Carey, a guy who worked with Wayne and Ford, I think, too, and many other people for a long time. So Olive played Mrs. Jorgensen, and John Quaylen plays Mr. Jorgensen.
He plays with a cartoonish accent.
Yeah, that over-the-top
he
Swedish
sounds
accent.
He sounds like the Swedish chef.
Olive is fine. She does a good job playing the mother. And Vera Miles playing Laurie is okay. I wouldn't say she's great, but she's okay. But yeah, he's a little bit silly.
I mean, they're playing for laughs, and it's funny. It's cute. It just feels like two movies that were mashed together. Two totally different tones and totally different intentions. And I like the serious movie better. I like the John Wayne plot. I can see how that could be viewed as a classic, but I guess it's just one of those films that once you've seen it enough, you learn to forgive the parts that stink and just enjoy the parts that work. This was one of those films, wasn't necessarily appreciated right away. It wasn't an instant classic. Like you said, it was never nominated for any Academy Awards. It took decades before critics really started looking back and appreciating it. So who knows, maybe, you know, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, you and I will have watched this movie a few more times and we'll see something that we're not seeing now because we can just filter out that stuff that doesn't work and focus on the stuff it does. But then, to
I think
me,
we
then,
did do that.
Well, I didn't, because I was going in with fresh eyes. I've never seen it before. Okay, that makes it a good film. I understand how you can forgive parts and carry on and appreciate what's good about it. But then, wouldn't you then say that a movie that doesn't have that flaw would be a better movie? And I just say that because Searchers say is above Shane on the list, and I loved Shane.
Yeah.
And I still, you know, weeks later, I'm still thinking about Shane. I'm still thinking about what a great movie had such an impact on me. And there was no distracting subplot in that. So wouldn't that make Shane a better movie than The Searchers?
And Shane is the last AFI movie that you liked full bore, no
oh,
arguments,
yeah.
no questions
yeah,
asked.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
You liked From Here to Eternity for the most part. And a lot of the ones lately, you've either been a little thumbs down or just like, okay, it's all right. But
yeah, Shane's the last one that I loved, for sure.
One of the things I did like, though, is another subplot aspect of it, and it isn't really dwelled on very much, maybe in the very beginning, is that John Wayne is fighting his age a little bit. And I don't think he's doing it as gracefully as, say, Clint Eastwood will. Now, Eastwood was older in Unforgiven, for example, than Wayne is in this movie. But they both have that past, too. And Eastwood started kind of acknowledging his past. Unforgiven is actually very funny. Another movie with a very serious theme, but does find ways to have some comedy. But it's mostly early on, and it's all about how I bumped my head falling off my horse, and now they're just kind of old, and they can't do this anymore. And John Wayne doesn't play into that. Not your uncle, nor Methuselah, nor grandpa.
Mm-hmm.
And even though he's the one character that does look a little older, the IMDb points out that even though it's supposed to have been about half a decade, Debbie clearly has gotten quite a bit older. No one else ages. But John Wayne does get gray in his hair. Maybe his face doesn't look much different.
5 years isn't going to age people that much, but it was a little ridiculous that they cast a woman in her 20s to play a 14-year-old mm-hmm. girl. That was pretty silly. I think it would have been more impactful had it been a girl that still looked like a child. Why'd they have to cast Natalie Wood? I mean, as a character, she isn't in the movie all that much.
No, she's not. And the young version of Debbie is actually Natalie's sister,
Lana Wood. That's so cool.
And here again, John Ford's using his stock company. He did that a lot of times where he used some of the same actors and the supporting roles. And of course, John Wayne was in Stagecoach and Searchers as the star.
How many John Ford movies was John Wayne in?
I think it was at least a dozen. And it wasn't always Western. Sometimes they were military movies. But he worked with Henry Fonda and Jamie Stewart quite a bit, too.
Mm-hmm. So one last thing about the themes before we move on, that is important to point out, mostly because it was something that was new in The Searchers, which is that they dealt with miscegenation. And as racist as Ethan is, and as much as race plays a part in his searching for revenge, he hates the Comanche so much, and yet he seems to know so much about them. Mm-hmm. He speaks their language. Scar speaks English. Martin is 1/8.
What is it? 1/8 what? I had that all ready to go.
Okay.
It's not Comanche.
It's
or else he might have been killed.
Yeah.
Ethan.
It's Cherokee.
There you go.
Yeah, he's 1/8 Cherokee. You got it. And I think anybody could genuinely debate where Debbie belongs at the end of her story here. When she's 14 years old and she's spent nearly half of her life with this tribe of people, does she really belong back with the Jorgensons?
No.
Or with this family that she's created? You might validly question which life would be better
for her. Taxi Driver, because in that case, the girl seems to want to be there as much as any young kid prostitute ever could be.
So you have the racism, you have these people with so much hate for each other, and yet they seem to be blending their cultures together, which is naturally what would happen in a situation like the Americas at that time in history.
Yeah, and it's happened more and more as we've gone along to the point where, for most people that we are friends with at least, they wouldn't think twice about miscegenating, whether it be them or friends or family. Now, all this is set in Monument Valley. The first film that Ford ever did, there was Stagecoach, which is our first Ford Wayne film way back when.
But that's where it's shot. That's not where it's set. It's set in Texas, but Monument Valley is in Utah.
Right. Because exactly, they're doing the Utah-Arizona border. That's where they're shooting it, but it's actually set in West Texas. And they end up in, I think, New Mexico and God knows where else.
Alberta. Some of it was shot in Alberta.
Okay, there you go. Yeah. But he liked to shoot in Monument Valley. He also had these weird sets. They seem so artificial. And they seem so stage-bound. They seem kind of cheap. The one set I did like, and I'm pretty sure it was actually a set, was just before the natives attack Aaron and the family. And there's a really good buildup of tension in that, too. It's dusk. It's really beautiful dusk.
Oh, yeah.
Both in the cabin and outside of it. That's as good a looking scene in the movie that is not taking advantage of Monument Valley.
Genuinely scary.
Mm-hmm. But beautiful looking is my point.
Yeah.
Okay, let's burn through the particulars of the actors and the director and writer and everybody. So John Wayne, this is the second time we're going to see him and the last time we're going to see him. He'd been a Stagecoach, of course. He also was in Red River, a very similar character in that film at times. Not the racism, but a guy who's driven by hatred and vengeance. It's funny how John Wayne and Jimmy Stewart, two guys who worked with John Ford a lot, and both guys who got into Westerns and who got darker as they get older, they're both known as these great heroic actors. But some of their best and most iconic works were in these roles where they were very close to being the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
and Wayne at times in Red River, which I don't think you've seen, right? Montgomery Clift's in that. That was his breakout role. Clift is his adopted son in that movie, and at one point in that film, he's out to get him. And yet they paint it in the early part of the movie where they're as close as it gets. So Wayne could play bad when it was set up to go that way.
Well, if you look at the list, it's proven over and over that the best characters are the characters that toe that line, are detestable, but you like them anyway. I mean, just look at the top five. You have Citizen Kane, you have The Godfather, you have Gone with the Wind, even Rick.
In Casablanca, yeah.
Yeah, he's probably the most genuinely heroic character in this list of movies.
And then Lawrence and Lawrence of Arabia. So to finish up Wayne's credits, he was also in The Quiet Man that Ford directed a few years before this. A lot of people love that movie. Sands of Iwo Jima, Rio Bravo, which we've talked about a few times. Maybe that'll be a 9-100, I don't know. We at least have to see it one day. And the original True Grit, where he won his only Oscar, and dozens more films. And I'd say he's easily the best thing in this film.
Isn't it true that he holds the record for starring in the most Hollywood films of any actor?
Could be. I never actually heard that. Maybe Christopher Lee has got to be on that list, too.
Yeah. As a star, though?
Well, and maybe they weren't all Hollywood.
Yeah.
He's up there, though. He's way up there. And I guess the other note I wanted to make about his character is that he has got more hatred in him than any character I can think of since Captain Bligh. Especially of a main character and not somebody who's a villain in the movie, but somebody who's either an anti-hero or a hero.
And, you know, we already talked about this with whether or not he's having an affair with Martha, but he hates himself.
Yeah.
That's why you forgive him. That's why he's interesting.
Yeah. And then Jeffrey Hunter, who does play Martin, he was later Jesus in King of Kings, and he was also in The Longest Day. Many actors were in that film. I'm sure we're going to mention that one many times because everybody seemed to have been in that.
I don't think I could pay much praise to him in this movie.
No.
Maybe more so because lately we've been watching all these great method actors, and then to go back to his old-fashioned, over-the-top, hyperbolic, and totally without depth or growth.
Yeah, he's outmatched by his co-star. And the supporting cast, we mentioned Natalie Wood. She's in back-to-back AFIs because last week we did Rebel Without a Cause, where she certainly was better. And you can see where her career could have gone, and did go, from her short career. And we're still going to see her one more time in West Side Story.
Ah, that's right.
Vera Miles, this is the first time we've got her on the list. She's got one more, and that'll be in Psycho. Both of these are supporting performances. Miles also is in The Wrong Man for Hitchcock, and The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, which co-stars Jimmy Stewart and John Wayne. That's a good film. Another one we maybe should watch one of these days. This is the final time we say this guy's name, Ward Bond, his seventh AFI movie. After playing a few cops in prior AFIers, now he plays a holy man and a soldier, all in one package.
We'll miss you, Ward.
Yeah, he had a pretty major role for once. He didn't really in a lot of those early ones. But this, and I guess It's a Wonderful Life, were those two most major performances. Yeah. And a white German named Harry Brandon played Scar.
He doesn't look Comanche.
No. The other Comanches were played by Navajo, actually. And apparently the language when they're talking, it is Navajo. John Quaylen, the Canadian, who was also in Casablanca, Grapes of Wrath, and The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. He played Jorgensen, the Swedish-accented fellow. Now, John Ford. Last time we talked about one of the great masters, I've said many times in discussions with you that if they had ever done an AFI top 100 directors list, that Ford would be, if not number one, number two.
Yeah.
Hitchcock would probably be the other one.
Yeah.
Because if it had been modern directors and other people voting, they revere these two guys. I know you've been a fan of his. This is the first time we've seen him, though, since Grapes of Wrath, 26 movies ago.
I can't speak from actually having seen these films, but from what I've read about him, he seems to be a bit like a Spielberg where he's hit and miss. He has made some stinkers. His early films were definitely not revered, and a lot of critics, you know, they love his masterpieces, but you will admit that he's not always on point.
Yeah.
But he does hold the record for the director with the most directing Oscars.
He won four.
Yep.
But as we said, trivia-wise, way back when, never for what he's known for the best, and that would be for the Westerns. And this case wasn't even on the short list, didn't even get nominated. Ford's screenwriter was Frank S. Nugent, who mostly wrote for Ford, Quiet Man and Mr. Roberts, among many others. And he based this screenplay on Alan LeMay's novel. A lot of that lately, where we've got movies based on books. Rebel Without a Cause, based on the title of a book.
And the book was based on an amalgamation of a few true stories of kidnapped girls.
Kidnapped and then the Stockholm Syndrome.
Yeah, and people obsessively finding them. There was one girl in particular where by the time they found her, she was in her 30s. And she desperately resisted going back with him.
I can understand that. What has she known better? Especially if you're that much older. If you were kidnapped as a young girl, that's two-thirds of your life you've been with these other people.
And we'll see that theme explored a little differently, but similar theme in Dances with Wolves.
A definite influence, yeah. It had to have been. Costner is a big fan of Westerns. He's talked about that many times, and I'm sure he's a big fan of John Ford in particular. Yeah, Mary McDonald's character
mm-hmm.
is essentially Debbie.
Except I think that she was an orphan that they took in, and then she was raised with the... Mm. I can't remember which tribe it was.
I forget now, too.
All right. Then we'll get to that eventually, though. Racist. We're probably as bad as Ethan.
That's one of the best ever Hollywood movies for seeing it from the other side. Showing yeah. their point of view.
Yeah, taking it completely the other way. Although it's still from the point of view of a white man.
Yeah, a lot of movies have been criticized for that. Glory, which was the year before Dances with Wolves, has a white guy in the lead of a movie that's about black former slaves becoming mm-hmm. soldiers and being heroic. Sometimes you have to do that to get, A, to get a movie made,
yeah.
and B, to get inside that story. We're still a racist part of the world over here, and certainly in America. It is taking time, but it is getting better, I like to think, at least.
It's still a step forward, I suppose, and it's still a good movie, just because it's not the movie that needs to be made, and I totally agree that movies from all different perspectives do need to be made. Doesn't mean it's not a good movie. I like that movie a lot.
Okay, so back to the credits for The Searchers. This is a C.V. Whitney picture. Never heard of him myself before. Well, I must have seen the credit before, but never really took note. He only produced three flicks. He did one with Lee Marvin and the other with Dennis Hopper. So not a long career for that guy as a producer. Cornelius Vanderbilt Whitney. And the executive producer is a name we've not talked about in quite a long time. Marion C. Cooper,
mm-hmm.
who directed and produced King Kong.
Yeah.
Way back when, one of our first ones. He also produced a lot of Ford flicks. They worked together quite a few times, including The Quiet Man. Good little movie. I think you'd like that one. That one's played more comedically.
Yeah.
But Cooper and Ford worked well together, and I think he must have been some kind of money man. Keep the suits away from Mr. Ford doing his thing.
Yeah, well, that's part of the reason why he shot in Monument Valley. It was
yeah,
just to keep...
no one could bother him.
All the Hollywood execs would never come near him because he was too far away. There was no telephones out there.
He was an iconoclast.
Apparently making a Western with him was like living a Western because yeah. they would go so far out that they would have to live in camps and eat beans out of cans.
Yeah. Technically speaking, the movie's widescreen again. We're going to stay with that theme for a while now. I thought this movie was a 4x3 movie, 1:3:1, but I was wrong about that. It is 1:6:6. It's also in VistaVision. And Technicolor, the cinematographer shooting the Technicolor, was Winton Hoch, I guess is how you say his name, H-O-C-H. He shot, again I'll say it, The Quiet Man and Mr. Roberts, and he won a total of 3 Oscars.
Hmm.
His work was respected quite well. Now, he also did The Day for Night, which is getting better compared to what we saw in Shane
yes.
and From Here to Eternity.
Well,
it's still not great.
A lot of those nice scenes were also shot in studio, so that could have something to
right.
do with it.
Well, those scenes, from that standpoint, are fine. The Day for Night stuff isn't really a problem because of the way they lit it.
Mm-hmm.
But when it's Day for Night out in the valley... you can simply see too far away for it to have been
yeah,
early nighttime.
Yeah.
One of those things.
It has the hard shadows.
Yeah. But also, again, like in Stagecoach, when you are inside, you got those low ceilings.
Yeah.
I guess it was Wells, who revered John Ford, decided that with Citizen Kane and other movies that he made, and Ford kept doing it too. And it's not like it's an impressionistic thing where the ceiling is an inch above somebody's head or
mm-hmm.
some German angle kind of thing.
Yeah.
But the fact you can see the ceiling kind of gives that hint that the world's coming down over these people. When they get outside, it's a whole different story. There is no ceiling, even close to a ceiling.
Mm-hmm. Probably an authenticity aspect to it as well.
Yeah. The composer was Max Steiner. He's done so many of our movies. I think we're getting close to the end of his run. He did Gone with the Wind, Casablanca, and Treasure of the Sierra Madre. How about your music thoughts this time?
Again, blanketed, kind of annoying.
Wasn't as much blanketed as it was
There was
before?
A few scenes, definitely. It wasn't overwhelming. In Shane, there's parts where it's just too loud to hear the character speak. I'll be happier when they get to the more modern leitmotif style.
We'll just wait till 2 weeks from now with 12 Angry Men where there's some music, but very little.
Yeah, I usually think less is more with yeah. music.
The influence of The Searchers is huge. Taxi Driver and Star Wars references we've already made, Dance with Wolves. David Lean was influenced big when he made Lawrence of Arabia to go back and watch this film and take some inspiration from it. And Sam Peckinpah, another big Western director, was a big fan of Ford in this film in particular. The Breaking Bad finale... we've talked about Breaking Bad quite a lot in these podcasts, surprisingly.
Yeah.
And Vince Gilligan said his finale was based, at least in part, on this film. That obsessive quest at the end.
Oh, okay.
And I guess the difference is that Walt is not wandering forever between the winds. We won't say what happens to him in case you haven't seen the end of Breaking Bad yet. And, of course, the shot of John Wayne and other people, as we said, we see it more than once. That inside-looking-out shot has been done by just about everybody. Almost
mm-hmm.
everybody's stolen that by now.
Although, is it stolen from that? I mean, it looked strikingly like that very famous shot from Wizard of Oz to me.
Yeah.
Can you give Ford credit for inventing that shot? He
Maybe
does it
for
well.
Doing it the way he does it. Maybe for the idea.
And for the thematic elements, it's
yeah.
a completely different message that he's
the
trying
to... The safety
of
home versus the dangers of being
yeah,
out there in the
yeah.
middle of nowhere.
Instead of opening up into a wild, wonderful new world, it's kind of the opposite.
Yeah. The last influence I want to make is 9/11. Because a lot of people still want vengeance for an inhuman group who killed people that day. People are Ethan Edwards in a lot of cases, and it's hard, for the same kind of reasons, it's almost hard to judge people for wanting that.
Well, I think what you're pointing out is how the film's theme is an acute observation of human nature.
Which may be why when they did
racism comes from.
And that may be why when they did the second list, why it rose up so much, because it was only a few years after 9/11 and people were still maybe in that frame of mind. That's what I mean by influence. More so on the way people feel about the film than the film itself.
Yeah.
Because obviously it predates 9/11 by so many years, so many decades. The awards section will not take me long. No Oscar nominations. The National Film Registry in 1989, the very first year. And it was number one in the Western category of the top 100 genres list, which is not a surprise either. Didn't make the throws list. I guess that's not a big shock. And Ethan certainly could not have made the heroes list. And he wasn't really strong to make a villains list either. Maybe he should have had some of the quotes. Another one I didn't say was, "We'll find him. I assure you that. Just as sure as the turn of the earth." Mm-hmm. While they're riding around in the snow. That's one thing that's nice. If they're supposed to be doing this for years, if there's going to be some snow, they're going to wander through some bad weather. And Rotten Tomatoes-wise, 100% of the critics were fans and 89% of audiences.
That's really good.
Another one I want to mention is that the film was 7th on the critics list in the 2012 Sight and Sound poll.
Yeah, that's right. So even Europeans love this movie.
Yeah.
It's not like it's just this American tale and it appeals to American critics. No, worldwide people love this film.
I think I read it was 5th one of those decades too. And it's been in the top 25, I would say, most of the last many decades.
I know, that surprised me. What do you think of that, being in the top 10 films of all time on the Sight and Sound
list? I wouldn't put it there. I wouldn't put it 12th on the AFI list either, partly because it seems weird to me that it would go up 84 spots. The other two that really rose so much, Vertigo and City Lights.
And The General which wasn't even on the list, and then it was, where did it rank?
18th. So that I take some issue with. And also because this film has this many flaws. I guess we're repeating ourselves now, but a film with this many subplots that don't really work, because who cares about the marriage between Charlie and Lori that is broken up by Martin? And Mose is relevant to the plot, but...
No, he's annoying.
But he's really annoying.
And it's surprising that so many critics would universally agree to look over those flaws and just see the parts of the film that work.
I don't think Hunter's as bad as you think he is, but he's certainly not great in the film.
No.
And then we've seen and will see better things from Natalie Wood and then even Vera Miles. So the movie's got too many flaws for it to be up that high. I certainly think it should be an AFI film, maybe in the top 50 or even top 25. A 12th is a little bit too much from my standpoint. But again, the AFI's second list is so debatable. A, with films they knocked off, B, with films they put on, and C, with where they moved them or didn't in some cases. If anything was going to go up that many spots, I would have thought it'd be one of three films, maybe even all three of three films. The Godfather Part II, Goodfellas, and Pulp Fiction. Yeah, they're all gangster films, but those films are as revered as any other out there.
Oh, yeah.
And one of them didn't move. Influence. Godfather Part II didn't move. Mm-hmm. The other two barely moved at all, and yet Searchers climbs all these spots.
Of all the things we've debated of what belongs on these lists and where they belong and whether they do or don't, I have much more passionate disagreements with other movies that are on the list than I do with The Searchers. I enjoy it. I'm glad that it's on the list. I'm glad that because it's on the list, we watched it and we're talking about it now. But, oh God, 12th. That's surprising.
One thing about that Rotten Tomatoes thing I just talked about, yes, 100% of the critics said thumbs up. But what was that thumbs up? What is it?
Yeah.
With reservations.
Yeah,
and how many of these 100% or 95% or 90% thumbs up reviews from the Rotten Tomatoes critics is enthusiastic?
That's true.
And that I do not
Every review I read tempered the recommendation with a warning about the flaws. Every single one. And there were old reviews from when it first came out in the 50s that I read where they just flat out were like, nice try, John Ford. There's stuff that works in this movie, but, you know, overall, it's not as best.
So much like one of the other ones that climbed a lot, Vertigo. Mm-hmm. Wasn't revered, although this did fine at the box office at least.
Yeah, that's true.
It wasn't a huge hit. But a film that was an enormous hit in that same year, 1956, our other 1956 film, is next week on the Top Notch Project, and that is our third straight Warner Brothers production and the final AFI for both Jimmy Dean and director George Stevens. And that movie is Giant.
Would you say that it was a giant hit?
I would say it was a giant hit. Because we can be awfully corny sometimes, including right now. So the coming attractions trivia for Giant, which was third in box office receipts for 1956 films. What two movies finished ahead of it?
So for the answer to that question, tune in to our next week's podcast. And if you'd like more trivia and lots more other fun stuff from Ryan and me, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. You can also find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. What did you think of The Searchers? Maybe you can shed some light on what it is exactly that we're missing about this film. Let us know. Send us an email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com.
Well, that'll be the day AA when I die.
And cut.